The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. My name is Susanna Sakotu, and I am the director of the War Crimes Research Office. Welcome to the WCRO's International Criminal Tribunals in the 21st Century Conference. For all the efforts that went into conceptualizing and orchestrating this program, it's really quite exhilarating to see you all here today. As you can see from the number of people in this room alone, we had an overwhelming response to today's conference. The tremendous level of interest is a testament both to the many distinguished speakers we will hear from in the course of the day, as well as the central importance of the issues that will be the subject of today's discussions. Let me take a few minutes to profile the work of the WCRO. The office was established in 1995 in response to a request for legal research assistance from then prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, Justice Richard Goldstone. Faced with bringing the first major prosecution since the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials, the ad hoc criminal tribunals found themselves at the frontiers of international criminal law. The WCRO was created as an outgrowth of the need for the kind of specialized legal research assistance and analysis that prosecuting cases of this kind required. The decade since then has seen an incredible number of developments in international criminal and humanitarian law. Media executives have been held accountable for incitement to genocide. Rape and other forms of sexual violence have been recognized not only as war crimes and crimes against humanity, but also instruments of genocide. And international tribunals have indicted two sitting heads of state, challenging traditional notions of head of state immunity. For the people on the front lines, these have been painstaking advances. But the milestones of the last decade alone have been breathtaking. At the same time, we've seen a number of new models of accountability emerge. In addition to the ad hocs, several new hybrid criminal courts were created, most under the auspices or with the support of the UN. And of course, in 2002, we had the coming into force of the first permanent international criminal court. Today, I think we find ourselves in a time of transition. The contemporary era of international criminal tribunals, which began in the early 1990s, is coming to a close. The ad hocs are expected to conclude their trial work by 2008 and appeals work by 2010. Similarly, the hybrid or internationalized courts created in the late 1990s have either ended or now approaching the end of their mandates. Meanwhile, some of the newer models of accountability, such as the extraordinary chambers in Cambodia and the specialized domestic war crimes chamber in Bosnia, are now getting off the ground. And of course, the ICC is currently investigating a number of possible cases and may well begin issuing its first new indictments in the near future. So as one episode of international criminal justice draws to a close, challenges continue to emerge. Throughout the decade of major developments, the core mandate of the WCRO has remained the same, to promote the development and enforcement of international criminal and humanitarian law through the provision of legal research assistance to international criminal courts and tribunals. With the participation of the law school's international faculty, former and current staff, JD and LLM students, and several expert consultants, the WCRO has undertaken more than 70 major research projects since its inception. Now, none of this would have been possible without the vision and dedication of Diana Ortlicker, professor of law at WCL, who helped found the office and served as its faculty director for its first 9 years, and, of course, the more recent contributions of Professor Robert Goldman, who has served as faculty director since last summer. Their mentorship and commitment to the office and the fields of international criminal and humanitarian law have been indispensable to the work of the WCRO. Now, before I turn to giving a little bit more background about Professor Goldman, I'd like to take a brief moment to thank the institutions that have made this conference possible. It is only because of the generous support of the Foreign Affairs Department of the Canadian government and Claudio Grossman, Dean of the Washington College of Law, who has been supportive of the WCRO since inception, that we are here today celebrating the WCRO's 10-year of service and debating some of the most pressing issues in international justice today. Their dedication to the work of the WCRO and international justice generally cannot be overstated. With that, I'd like to introduce Professor Goldman. Professor Goldman has taught at the school since 1971. He has served in so many distinguished capacities, it's hard to know where to start, but I'll highlight just a few. Professor Goldman was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights from 1996 to 2003, where he also served as its president from March 1999 to March 2000. In July 2004, he was appointed the UN Human Rights Commission's independent expert on protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms while countering terrorism. A year later, he was named one of the 8 members of the International Commission of Jurists Eminent Jurist Panel on Counterterrorism and Human Rights. His contribution and dedication to the field of international humanitarian law in particular are nothing short of extraordinary. With that, I will turn this morning's proceedings over to Professor Goldman.
Well, it's very nice to be with you today, and I must say to see a bunch of former students who have gone out and done such terrific work in the field of human rights and also humanitarian law. I've actually had a very easy job. Diane Ortlicker, for 9 years, shepherded together with the students in a student-generated program that Diane responded to. Left this in such good shape, and then with the under the leadership of the director, Susanna Sakoto, I get a lot of credit, and I really don't have to do very much work, and that is always nice for an academic. I shouldn't say that in front of the dean. But nonetheless, it's been a beautifully sailing ship. This is one of the crown jewels, really, for the law school. And it would not have been possible, really, without Dean Grossman's recognition that you need to invest money in order to get something good going. And he supported this. We have gotten funding. We have many of our funders with us today. I, too, join with Susanna in thanking the Department of Foreign Affairs of Canada for their support of this particular activity. Claudio needs little introduction to many people here. We had the good fortune of serving together on the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, where he also served 8 years, and Claudio also served unprecedentedly twice as president of that, and he has most recently continued to deal with issues of great importance as one of the members of the UN Committee Against Torture. So I'm very pleased to introduce Claudio Grossman just to say a few words to you. Thank you.
I wanted to be here today to welcome all of you on behalf of the Washington College of Law to our campus to celebrate the 10th anniversary of our War Crimes Research Office. This type of conferences and the support of the law school for them respond to a vision of opening the law schools to address by experts, judges, practitioners, important issues of our time. There is hardly an issue in our societies that lacks a legal component, and certainly this matters then in order to assist individuals to understand the complexities, could be illuminated by the enlightened debate of practitioners, lawyers, and academics. We have in the law school over 50 conferences per year, attracting more than 7,000 academics, judges, and practitioners. And again, the role is rests on a vision of opening a domain and a space that will contribute on the understanding of fundamental issues of our time. But this is a special conference because in addition to importance of the topic, we are addressing the issue of international criminal tribunals in the 21st century. And the relevance of the topic will be, of course, analyzed and debated later, and I'll make a few comments as well. But the importance of the topic is also shown because the event brings together many distinguished individuals who will share their unique and express perspectives on this important issue. We are very pleased that all of you could make it today and look forward to hearing and learning through this conference. Behind a conference also, there is a tremendous effort and work, and I want to thank the War Crimes Research Office, its director, Susana Sakuoto, which is a very dangerous individual, always pressing tirelessly for resources and creating opportunities for students. I'm sure Susana, we will continue to hear from her and from her tremendous contributions and knowledge and her staff member. As well as Professor Diane Oren-Liker, I remember when she started with this idea, she conceptualized this idea, it's her idea in this institution. She also put the time, effort, and in addition to her job as a faculty member with a full teaching load and numerous research activities, this should be seen as a gigantic effort, a gigantic pro bono effort to contribute to important matters of our time. So we thank Diane for her tremendous contribution. She has been followed by Bob Goldman. Anything that I say about Goldman should, of course, be taken with a grain of salt because I served with him during six years in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and what I say is absolutely tainted by my vision of him. I don't know of a person with more integrity and strength than Bob Goldman. And there is a old say that says, if you save a person, you save the whole world. And I saw in the Inter-American Commission how Bob is responsible to save many people and also for structural change in terms of the Inter-American system. I thank both of them for their efforts in making this tremendous event a reality. Now, the topic of International Criminal Tribunal raises some of today's most pressing issues concerning, for example, justice, responsibility, accountability, and peace. And these are not rhetorical issues, as we're coming perhaps out from the most criminal century in the history of humankind, the 20th century, and the 21st century is not looking much better. I think that these topics do not relate just with the future. Never history concerned the future. As Carl said, concerned the past. History is about the future. And as we're talking about this issue, we're talking about the world that we imagine and the world we want to shape and the world where we want to live. The program also involves the interplay between international law, comparative law, and domestic laws. These are issues especially important today in this age of globalization, where we find terrorist activities, international crime, poverty, deprivation. And all these matters relate to sovereignty, the relationship between domestic and international concerns, and ultimately our theories and concepts underlying justice, sovereignty, international law, and domestic governance. It's difficult to find an issue of more relevance than the one we're going to address today. It challenges the classic notions of international law where only states were responsible and violators of human rights could hide behind the states and state sovereignty and be impugned for things that we consider outrageous and resulted in the horrendous destruction of life and resources of humankind. So I hope this conference will contribute greatly to push further for integrity, for accountability, for responsibility of human beings, particularly or when, as we have seen, countries are unwilling or unable on occasions to do justice, and again, because of globalization, those are not simply domestic matters but have an impact in the life of all of us. I would like to extend on behalf of our community our deep gratitude also to the funding organizations of this of the War Crimes Research Office, which in addition to the resources invested by the law school include the Open Society Institute, the Open Society Justice Initiative, the JET Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and Foreign Affairs Canada. We're distinguished by the support, and we will continue to work together to achieve common goals of justice and law. Thank all of you very much for your support to the War Crimes Research Office, and please enjoy today's exciting event. Thank you very much.
I've been asked to say a few words about Aryeh Nair as we begin the first panel approaching the next era of war crimes tribunals. I suspect with this audience, Aryeh needs little introduction. Before he joined the Open Society Institute and the Soros Foundations as president in 1993, Aryeh spent 12 years as a executive director of Human Rights Watch, of which he was a founder in 1978. I would just note parenthetically that I had the good fortune for about 10 of those years to work quite closely with Aryeh at America's Watch, where I suspect we gave more than one Malox moment to the Reagan administration. Prior to that position, Aryeh had worked for the American Civil Liberties Union for 15 years and during eight as the National Executive Director. He has been the recipient of numerous awards, also honorary degrees, also from this university. He is the author of various books, and an extremely good read would be his most recent book, 2003, called Taking Liberties. I should also mention that Aryeh sort of was one of the people who helped to invent the somewhat catchy titles to human rights reports. This really started during the period of Human Rights Watch, and it has continued, and it's worked its way into the rest of the human rights community. There is no voice, I think, in the field of human rights, in which we are more interested in hearing, and I'm very pleased, therefore, to present my friend, Aryeh Nair. After Aryeh finishes, Diane Ortlicker, as a discussant, will be commenting on his remarks. Thank you, Aryeh.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. This law school has played a central role in efforts on behalf of human rights internationally, and therefore it is the venue in which I feel it is most appropriate to be discussing the issues that will concern us today. I've been asked to talk about the next era in war crimes tribunals, but I really can't do so without reflecting briefly on the past era. The era that has passed has really lasted a very short period. I was reminiscing with Bob Goldman yesterday evening about how long it has been since even the question of accountability for great crimes became an issue. And it was really only a little over 20 years ago that it became an issue for the first time. At that moment, there was no thought of international criminal tribunals. It was still the Cold War era, and one could not have created such a tribunal in that era, but it was focused on national remedies for great abuses of human rights, and it was the period in which both criminal trials and what became known as truth commissions were launched to try to address the abuses that had taken place in various countries during periods of military dictatorship in the immediate aftermath of the end of those dictatorships. I recall issuing a call for the establishment of what became the Yugoslav Tribunal. The call was issued in July 1992, and none of us who were involved in that early effort could have imagined the development that has taken place since then. So the fact that we now have ad hoc tribunals, which are beginning to map out the conclusion of their work, the fact that we have hybrid tribunals, the fact that we have an international criminal court, even though those institutions have sometimes been frustrating because they have seemed to proceed very slowly, as in the conduct of the Milosevic trial. From a historical standpoint, this has all transpired in the blink of an eye. It's something that, as I say, that would have been unimaginable, was unimaginable, to those of us who were involved in trying to invent this way of proceeding. When one thinks of the next era, I believe that the most important task that confronts those who are concerned with international justice is to make certain that the current tribunals conclude their work properly. And that's a very difficult and a very expensive task. There are many matters which were not thought of at the moment that the tribunals were created, which one has to think of now. What happens to the evidence, what happens to the archives, what happens to the prisoners, all of that, what happens to the witnesses, all of that has to be addressed at this point, and the assessment of how well the tribunals have performed will have a great deal to do with the manner in which they conclude their work. And that assessment is crucial if the next era in war crimes tribunals is to get off to an appropriate start. I think that the next era has to, in some respect, proceed along the lines of the current era. I think it's clear that we will need more hybrid tribunals in different parts of the world in order to address the particular crimes that have taken place in given countries. It is not going to be possible for the International Criminal Court to be a panacea in addressing the range and the severity of such crimes. It will not have the capacity to go into the depth in particular countries that is required in order to make whole and to restore a sense of justice within those countries. And so I think that hybrid tribunals will continue to be needed. But I think that an additional development which we need to start thinking about is the establishment of regional tribunals under the auspices of various regional international bodies. Unfortunately, there are not such bodies in all parts of the world which one could imagine as sponsors of such tribunals. There are such bodies in Europe, in Latin America, and in Africa, but there really is nothing in Asia that is ASEAN. One regional body in Asia has no human rights mechanism whatsoever, and even though there have been a few suggestions for the establishment of a human rights mechanism within ASEAN, with a majority of the countries in that regional body abusers of human rights rather than defenders of human rights, that is, such countries as Burma and Vietnam and Singapore and Malaysia and Laos are members of ASEAN. It's going to be extremely difficult to establish any kind of regional mechanism. And of course, ASEAN covers some 10 countries of Asia, but there are many countries of Asia that are not part of any such regional body. Most obviously, China, which is a world unto itself, is not part of any such regional body. So there is a limit to what one can achieve if one creates tribunals under the auspices of regional bodies. The Middle East is also obviously an area where it would be virtually impossible to establish such a body. But I don't think the fact that there are going to be these difficulties should deter one from thinking in these terms. At this moment, the cases on which the International Criminal Court is focusing are all African cases. The prosecutor for the International Criminal Court is very sensitive about this. He does not want, and I think he's right on this, he does not want the court to appear as a court for Africa. In dealing with leaders of the African Union, this is one of the major problems that he encounters. And so if there were an African court, that would be most valuable, because in fact there are other circumstances in Africa besides those that are now under consideration by the International Criminal Court, which require the attention of an international criminal tribunal, and the establishment of an African court would suggest that Africa is willing to deal with its own gross abuses for human rights, and that an international criminal court could genuinely be international, dealing with other parts of the world, dealing with Colombia, dealing with Afghanistan, dealing with other circumstances where its work would be required, and not having to focus exclusively or almost exclusively on Africa. I would say that as the International Criminal Court develops, I do believe that one aspect of the next era in war crimes tribunals will develop on its own. And that is, I think that the complementarity will become a more significant factor. That is, as prosecutions are actually brought, I think more governments will decide that it is better for them to try to put their own houses in order, to try to address the abuses of human rights, the gross abuses within their own domestic criminal justice systems, rather than have the matters taken over by the International Criminal Court. And I think that would be a very healthy development. I don't think we can expect complementarity to be so significant a factor until somewhat later on, but I think as the International Criminal Court proceeds, it will become an increasingly significant factor. I think it is going to be necessary for the international tribunals to consider seriously jurisprudential matters that will expedite their efforts. Question of plea bargaining, I think, has to be considered more seriously by all of the international criminal tribunals in order to cope with the volume of cases. We know, for instance, that the American system of criminal justice would simply collapse if it were not for plea bargaining. The international criminal justice system also faces, because of the complexity of the trials and cases, the possibility of becoming bogged down by the quantity of cases, and I think plea bargaining would enhance the capacity of the tribunals to reach a larger number of those who should be brought before them. The final point I want to make about the future of international criminal tribunals is I think that we need a better funding mechanism than we now have for the international criminal tribunals. And unfortunately, we have a model which is working right now, which we can consider. It seems to me the model is the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. That is funded by governments. Its funding decisions are made by a technical review panel that examines applications coming from different countries around the world. It not only funds governmental efforts to address the diseases that are within its mandate, but where it thinks that that's not the appropriate mechanism, it will either go to an international agency such as the United Nations Development Program, or, for example, in the case of Russia, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria has provided funding through non-governmental institutions. And then the decisions of the technical review panel, an expert committee, are reviewed by the board of the Global Fund, which represents the donors. But so far, the board of the Global Fund has always endorsed the decisions of the technical review panel. There has been no instance so far in which political decision making has interfered with the funding by the Global Fund, and it is emerging as an extremely effective international instrument. The Global Fund's budget for the coming year is $3.6 billion. It aspires to spend a much larger amount of money per year going forward. The funding formula that had been conceived some time ago was that one-third of the funding would come from the United States, one-third from the countries of the European Union, and one-third from all other donors. In practice, it's more like one-third from the United States, 50% from the countries of the European Union, and the remainder from from other countries. But it insulates the governments from the donor governments from direct relationship to the expenditure, and that helps to depoliticize the funding, and it creates a sense of responsibility by the donor governments to deal with the diseases which are within the mandate of the Global Fund. I don't think we can now start work on a Global Fund for Justice, but that's what I think is required in the next era of war crimes tribunals. And it could be much smaller than the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria if $1 billion a year were available to a Global Fund to Fight Global Fund for Justice. That would be more than adequate to cover the needs in this field as they will develop for some time ahead. And I think that would be a way to remove this from the always pinched budgets of the United Nations, the political decisions that enter into the decision making there, and the need for the officials of the different international criminal tribunals to spend some of their time going around hat in hand, trying to raise the funds that are needed for the operation of these tribunals. So if 3 or 4 or 5 years from now we can get to the point of establishing such a Global Fund for Justice, I think that we would make a significant advance this field. And again, I think it's appropriate to think in these terms because we did not think through At the time that the international criminal tribunals were being launched, many such questions as what would be necessary for funding purposes. And I think we can think ambitiously. We have seen that the reality has far exceeded the ambitions of those who were involved in creating the current era of international criminal tribunals. So I believe there is no reason to hold back in thinking about what might be done in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to do just about anything alongside Arye Nair, especially when it has to do with the subject of war crimes tribunals. As previous speakers have indicated, Arye provided crucial leadership at the very inception of the tribunals, in fact, before they were created. And he has consistently since then been one of the best friends the tribunals have. As you've seen an example of what I mean just now, at crucial points, at crucial turning points in the development of war crimes tribunals, when we needed to think clearly and creatively about the path ahead, Arye has had very insightful suggestions, and he has helped push the rest of us to act on them to make this process more effective. I was especially impressed by the suggestion Arye made about establishing a global fund for peace. I was in Geneva last week in a meeting with field people who work for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the purpose of that meeting was it was a training session for field people with the UN High Commissioner's Office and with local representatives of civil society in countries where issues of justice are urgently important. And we were training these people in implementation of two sets of principles, one of which I helped draft that had been adopted or endorsed by the Commission on Human Rights. The principles I was involved in involved combating impunity. And one of the points I made at the end of this two-day program was that in my capacity, former capacity as the UN's independent expert on combating impunity, I constantly heard from victims in countries that didn't have a war crimes tribunal or a hybrid tribunal or domestic prosecutions or even truth commissions who said, what about us? We desperately need some kind of justice. And the message from the international community is we're exhausted. This costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. Tribunal fatigue is a real dynamic on the international level. And yet it's so obvious from the ground, from the view of victims, that you need some kind of process in place to ensure that there is some kind of reaction that kicks in when atrocious crimes occur and victims need justice. So I hope you'll revise your judgment that the time is not yet ripe to move forward on this, because I think it's actually an urgently important note. I also want to say on a more parochial note that I think it's especially appropriate. I was delighted that Arye was invited to kick off this conference, which coincides with the 10th anniversary of the War Crimes Research Office, because very simply it wouldn't exist without him. His support was essential from the outset. As Arye's remarks indicated, and as Susanna's remarks indicated, this conference comes at a time when those of us who have been involved with the work of war crimes tribunals are taking stock of what we've learned in the past decade. One chapter, as our previous speakers have indicated, is now drawing to an end, and the wind-down period of the first tribunals at a time when they are, in fact, in high gear presents unique challenges that we haven't yet faced. But in the meantime, we're moving forward in the establishment of a new set of tribunals and infinitely new models of justice, and we're trying to figure out what we've learned about how to do this better so that we can ensure justice in a more meaningful way in the future. As Arye indicated already, I think, and I want to really emphasize this point, those of us who've been involved in the work of tribunals for the past dozen years or so, I think have all been struck and maybe perhaps surprised by just how complex the challenges are. When I think back to the challenges we were consumed by 10 years ago, they were hard challenges, but they were relatively straightforward. We were consumed with the question of how do you arrest people who have been indicted by the Yugoslavia War Crimes Tribunal. We were consumed with the question of how you give the tribunals a reasonable shot at getting resources necessary to carry on their very labor-intensive work. And those of us who were involved in the work of the War Crimes Office and similar projects were worried about how you get the law right. And as hard as those jobs were, as hard as those challenges were, I think we've come to appreciate that the challenges presented by this whole project are in fact infinitely more complex than we ever imagined. Arya gave an example of the challenge of what to do with archives, what to do with defendants, either those who've been convicted but might someday bring a challenge based on new evidence after the war crimes tribunals have closed up shop, what to do with people who should have been indicted but the Yugoslavia tribunal ended its business before it had a chance to indict them. All of those issues give us a sense of the complexity of this project. But I want to turn and very briefly talk about a sort of big picture challenge that I think has come to define one of the most important challenges that we have faced and struggled to get right. It has to do with what those of us who work in this area call somewhat clinically outreach. For those of you who aren't steeped in the jargon of war crimes tribunals, the term is generally used to refer to the need for tribunals to make sure that they literally reach out to the communities of concern, to the victim communities, to the communities where terrible crimes occurred for a whole host of reasons, but very basically to make sure that victims understand what kinds of justice are being pursued in their names, to make sure that political leaders don't distort the message of the tribunals and deform the interpretation of what the tribunals are doing because the tribunals aren't speaking themselves more directly to the communities who are concerned in their work. But I'd like to suggest that the image of outreach, which I've used a lot myself, is not adequate, and in fact it may be the wrong metaphor. I think we're now at a point where we're moving from outreach to engagement, and we need to understand how important it is to understand that tribunals don't operate in a universe apart from victim communities. They have to, if they are going to be as successful as they need to be, they have to somehow engage in a constant way with communities. The engagement has to be two-way. It can't be just about explaining to victim communities and civil society at large and public officials, here's what we're doing, here's our prosecutorial strategy, here's why we're doing it this way. It's also about listening to communities, understanding how they perceive the work of the tribunals, so that tribunals can, in fact, craft a message of justice that's meaningful to local communities as well as to the international community. excuse me, as Arya's remarks indicated, that process has certainly begun. It's embodied in the model of hybrid courts, which operate so far in the countries where atrocious crimes occurred. So far, the model of these tribunals has been to establish a partnership between international actors and local actors so that there's a greater chance that communities will believe that justice really is being done in their name, that they own the process, and so that there's a legacy of enhanced justice at home. Justice doesn't happen in The Hague and then close up shop and go away. Justice begins to build at home so that victims can look to a future of enhanced protection of human rights in the future. I see that time is running short, so I want to very quickly turn to another point that matters quite deeply to me. We've learned a lot in the past 12 years, but we have a whole lot more to learn about the impact of tribunals on victims and on perpetrators and on communities as a whole. And I'm struck when I read political science literature in particular about the effects of other types of international intervention, how little analysis there has been that's similar to that when it comes to war crimes tribunals. And so I sort of want to put out an agenda for research for those of us who work in this area. I want to acknowledge that one exception to what I've said is sitting in our audience. Eric Stover, who'll be speaking later today, has done the kind of work I'm talking about. He's interviewed victims, done scientific studies of victims and other members of local communities in Bosnia and perhaps elsewhere to try to assess the impact of tribunals on their work. And it goes without saying that these kinds of analyses have to be refined. The question isn't just what impact does a tribunal have, but what impact do particular strategic choices of the prosecutor have on local communities? Is there a difference in the experience of victims when they receive counseling and follow-up from a tribunal than when victims don't receive that kind of assistance? I mean, there's a whole host of questions we need to pay attention to so that we know, so that we actually know what we're the impact we're having. finally, I want to just close by saying that there are many challenges that have been presented to war crimes tribunals. I see Luis Moreno Campos sitting here, and I imagine Luis constantly being in some ways in a hot seat because so many people have so many expectations of him. And I, from where I sit, Luis has done an extraordinary job already of engaging with local communities to convey to them that he's not an international prosecutor sitting in The Hague removed from them, but he's their prosecutor engaging with them. And he knows, I think, better than I can ever imagine how complex the job is of meeting public expectations and how many opportunities there are to founder because we, so many communities expect so much and sometimes so many different things. And so, against all that complexity, I sort of want to come back to one very simple point. I don't think we should lose sight of how important justice is to victims. And I emphasize that because there is now a growing literature questioning whether tribunals are that helpful for victims. And from my experience, justice is desperately important to victims. Not to say that all victims are the same by any means, but let me close by mentioning an example of the kind of research I have in mind when I sort of made a plea for a research agenda for tribunals. This has to do with research that's been done in this country. I recently learned of a study which I haven't yet seen. I'm trying to get my hands on it. What it found was that the way that the public viewed victims in this country correlated quite neatly with how much punishment, if any, their perpetrators received. And so if a victim of a terrible crime didn't get any justice in court, ironically, instead of the public feeling as though they had betrayed this victim, somehow felt that the victim deserved it, whereas victims who received some measure of justice were valued more highly, and those whose perpetrators received severe punishment were valued the most highly. So I think our sort of guiding star through all the complexity has to be a recognition that at the end of the day, it's all about victims and how we value them. Thank you.
Thank you both for those very insightful remarks and the wonderful, thoughtful kickoff to today's conference. I invite the panelists of our next panel to come forward. Thank you.